The Fourth District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has now convened. The Honorable James A. Kinect presiding.
This is our first case, 421-0475, consolidated with 421-0635, People of the State of Illinois versus Jermaine Wallace. For the appellant, Mr. Draws, would you introduce yourself to us, please?
Leo Draws with the Office of the State Appellate Defender, representing appellant Jermaine Wallace.
And for the appellee?
My name is David Manchin. I'm with the appellate prosecutor. I'm arguing on behalf of the state.
Thank you. You may proceed, Mr. Draws.
Thank you and good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Leo Draws and I represent appellant Jermaine Wallace. In light of the many issues in this appeal, I would like to offer a brief roadmap of this oral argument. First, the state's evidence that Mr. Wallace's license was suspended is lacking. Second, the state also failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Wallace knew there were firearms in the glove box of his wife's car. Third, the trial court erred in two ways when deciding guilt or innocence in this case. The first way it erred is that it used a 17-year-old conviction against Mr. Wallace's credibility, running contrary to the Illinois Supreme Court's decision in People v. Montgomery. And the second way the trial court erred is that it used irrelevant facts occurring at a much later time and place to find that Mr. Wallace retroactively had knowledge of the firearms in the glove box. Additionally, and fourth, Officer Campbell did not have reasonable suspicion to stop Mr. Wallace, which I will argue time permitting. And finally, I want to mention that I have in fact conceded argument five, Mr. Wallace's term of MSR is correct. Turning to the sufficiency of the evidence as to whether Mr. Wallace's license was suspended at the time of the stop, the state's entire case on this charge is predicated on this letter from the state of Georgia, and it's just too ambiguous to prove anything. The important date to remember here is May 2nd, 2019. The state has to show that Mr. Wallace's license was suspended on that date. And simply put, I look at this letter, I see three or four dates here. None of them are May 2nd, 2019. In fact, none of them are within a year of that date. I think that's the state's first problem here with this letter. The second problem is the letter gives two requirements for Mr. Wallace to have his license reinstated. And in after those two requirements, it says in bold letters, all capital letters, requirement met. There's just nothing here proving that Mr. Wallace's license was suspended at the time of the stop. Now, turning to the unlawful possession of a weapon by a felon charges here, and that would be count one and two, the state did not prove the knowledge element. And under Illinois law, knowledge means conscious awareness. Mr. Wallace had to be consciously aware at the time of the stop. This is a fact-specific inquiry, so let's go ahead and look at the facts here. First, the car belonged to Mr. Wallace's wife, Dorothy Porter. They didn't live together at the time of this, occurred. Second, Mr. Wallace borrows the car in a hurry to attend the funeral of a family member out of state. He's in a hurry. He doesn't have time to check every nook and cranny of the car. The guns belong to Ms. Porter. She testified to this. She said she kept them in the glove box to keep them away from the younger children present in her home. She also said that she didn't tell Mr. Wallace about them, about their presence in the glove box. And some details about the glove box here. This isn't a situation where you just go ahead and pop the glove box open. It actually locks, and it locks with a key. And Ms. Porter testified that that process was not intuitive. She had to go back to the dealership to understand how it worked because the car had a key fob. It wasn't a normal key that you plug into the ignition. You have to pop the key out, unlock the glove box that way. Mr. Wallace maintained throughout this entire encounter, he never opened the glove box. He didn't know how it opened. He respected his wife's privacy. He had no idea the firearms were in there. Then we look at what Officer Campbell did when he finds them. He doesn't take any steps to preserve DNA, fingerprint, any kind of evidence like that. He handles them with his bare hands, such that any latent fingerprints, nothing like that would have been helpful anyway. And I want to additionally note that the judge below said that the defense's arguments as to counts one and two, he called them compelling. Effectively, the state's argument here and at trial is that constructive possession equals knowledge. That's not enough. There are two distinct elements. It had to prove knowledge, and it didn't do so here.
Counsel, I want to ask you about the traffic stop that you say the trial court erred by denying the motion to suppress. The officer involved who stopped the car, Officer Deputy Campbell, said he had received a response through NCIC from Georgia authorities, the defendant's vehicle was not covered by insurance. Why wasn't that sufficient to justify the deputy to stop the car? Why didn't it count at least grounds for a Terry stop to have this further checked out?
Your Honor, I want to note that this does, well, first, no, this did not lead to reasonable suspicion. I would also further note that while I understand forfeiture is not a limitation on this court, it is a limitation on the parties. The state never at any point in the briefing argued that this NCIC or leads or whatever it may be flagging of this Georgia insurance requirement was in fact a valid basis for the stop. And that is because it is an out of state insurance registration requirement. When you're and Officer Campbell testified about this, he seemed honestly a little bit unsure about how exactly this requirement relates to Georgia, because it's not a requirement in Illinois.
Well, is it your contention that the Illinois Vehicle Code doesn't require people who are driving vehicles registered out of state like here to have automobile insurance?
Your Honor, the out-of-state vehicles, those driving out-of-state vehicles in Illinois, are not subject to the same requirements, requirements in the Illinois Vehicular Code. And the reason for that is because the Illinois legislature in the Illinois Vehicular Code creates these carve-outs because, like window tinting, maybe insurance registration requirements.
Let me give you a specific section, counsel. Section 7601 of the Illinois Vehicle Code says, paragraph D, no person shall operate a motor vehicle registered in another state upon the highways of this state unless the vehicle is covered by a liability insurance policy. The operator of the vehicle shall carry it within the vehicle, evidence of the insurance. Why doesn't that cover here so that it says, you have a car registered in Georgia, but you can't be operating it in Illinois unless you have insurance?
Your Honor, the problem here is that, and there are additional carve-out sections in the Illinois Vehicular Code. Specifically, I would point to 625 ILCS, and that would be section 5.3.402. I cite to it in the brief. It deals with registration requirements and other requirements of vehicles in Illinois. And it has particular carve-outs. It states, and I read, any motor vehicle it doesn't fall under these same requirements if it falls under one of these categories. And one of the categories is any motor vehicle, trailer, semi-trailer, or pole trailer operated interstate need not be registered in the state. And that's provided that it's that their insurance is registered in Georgia. I also want to note that this isn't a flagging that says, hey, this car doesn't have insurance. What this is a Georgia-specific requirement whereby the owner of the vehicle or the insurance company that provides insurance to the vehicle registers with the Georgia version of the Department of Motor Vehicles. It's not a flagging that says this vehicle doesn't have insurance. Officer Campbell said that, you can't tell that. You can't tell when you drive alongside a car that it doesn't have insurance.
Well, Campbell said he received information through NCIC from the Georgia authorities. The defendant's vehicle was not covered by insurance. Now, first question is there any reason that he couldn't place reliability upon that information?
Again, Your Honor, no. In terms of answering that question, is a leads flagging an NCI flagging? Is that reliable? Yeah. Yes. I don't. I don't know any reason that it necessarily wouldn't be in that circumstance. Well, again, though,
given that it's reliable information that this car bearing Georgia plates, according to Georgia authorities, was not covered by insurance, why wasn't that enough for reasonable, articulable basis to stop the car and see if it was otherwise in compliance with the Illinois statute that I just read to you, namely, no person shall operate a motor vehicle registered in another state upon the highways of this state unless the vehicle is covered by a liability insurance policy.
Again, Your Honor,
given reason to think maybe this isn't covered by a liability insurance policy?
It doesn't lead to reasonable suspicion here, Your Honor. This is an out-of-state requirement. This is not an Illinois requirement here. And again, the flagging isn't saying this vehicle doesn't have insurance. The flagging is related to a registration directly with the Georgia Department of Motor Vehicles. I would also point to the second district case, Patty, People v. Patty, that I cited to in this brief. It deals with these legislative carve-outs that are made for requirements in the Illinois Vehicle Code that out-of-state drivers, in that case, the stop couldn't be prolonged based on an Illinois insurance requirement. In this case, there wasn't reasonable suspicion to prolong the stop. Here, there's not reasonable suspicion to initiate the stop in the first place based on this requirement, because it's subjecting an out-of-state driver to Illinois vehicular codes.
Specifically says you may be registered in another state, but you can't be driving on the highway of Illinois without insurance. How is that a problem?
Because there's no reasonable suspicion that the driver is operating the vehicle without insurance here. The flagging has to do with a registration requirement in Georgia. It doesn't say that there's no valid insurance on this vehicle. Again,
that's exactly what Campbell testified to, wasn't it? Didn't he say that he received a response from NCIC, from the Georgia authorities, this is a Georgia vehicle, the defendant's vehicle was not covered by insurance. What part of that, what am I missing here? Why, if you're Deputy Campbell, why doesn't that tell you at least, gee, I don't think this car may have insurance, I'm gonna pull it over and check.
Your Honor, it has to do with the actual specific flagging itself here. It's a flag, how Georgia operates its vehicle code is different than Illinois and quite frankly a lot of other states. For example, in Illinois, I have State Farm. I don't go directly to the Department of Motor Vehicles here and show them this is my insurance. This insurance is valid and registered to this particular vehicle. I don't have to do that. There's no such requirement in Illinois to do such a thing. This is a requirement to take this step to actually register the insurance with the Department of Motor Vehicles that's present in Georgia. Officer Campbell said he had to kind of take a guess as to what exactly it was. And again, both of the articulated reasons for reasonable suspicion here, this window tinting issue, and then this leads alert for this Georgia registration requirement type of situation, these both run afoul of the Commerce Clause. It's impossible for a driver to change their window tinting as they cross state lines or change what their insurance covers, what it doesn't cover. It would put an absolute undue burden on that within the Commerce Clause on traveling between states here. I do want to go back and talk a little bit about the trial court errors here, because while I argue that the state didn't prove these charges beyond a reasonable doubt here, if this court does find that the state did in fact meet its burden, did prove these charges beyond a reasonable doubt, this case should be remanded due to these trial court errors. And both of these trial court errors went directly to deciding guilt and innocence, went directly to deciding guilt and innocence on counts one and two here, which are the firearms charges. First, the court ran completely afoul of People v. Montgomery. It didn't conduct a Montgomery hearing, and it erred by considering a 2003 cannabis-related felony against Mr. Wallace's credibility here. In fact, the court said that Mr. Wallace's testimony, his word carries, quote, less weight when talking about whether Mr. Wallace had knowledge of those firearms in the glove box. Now, under People v. Montgomery, there's several limiting factors, sort of tests that prohibit a prior felony conviction from being used against one's credibility. The important one here is that 10-year time limit. Mr. Wallace was convicted and released nearly 17 years prior to when he testified in this case. It's important because what the state is tasked with is proving the present alleged conduct. Guilt and innocence should not, in the present case, should not be decided based upon whether or not the defendant here has passed felony convictions. The judge's consideration of that prior felony conviction directly against Mr. Wallace's credibility frustrates the entire purpose that the Illinois Supreme Court handed down in People v. Montgomery.
Trial court found defendant's wife not to be credible with regard to her testimony that the guns belonged to her. Isn't that right?
Your Honor, the trial court did call into question both the testimony of Ms. Porter, also Mr. Wallace as well. However, it's Mr. Wallace's knowledge that's the key element here to counts one and two. And the trial court found Mr. Wallace not credible, at least part, decided that his weight had less credibility, that his weight carried less word because of a felony conviction that he was released 17 years prior on. Additionally, the second trial court error deals with considering irrelevant evidence to find retrospectively that Mr. Wallace had knowledge of the presence of the firearms locked in the glove box. Now, while all charges were tried together in this case, there's effectively two sort of timelines the way I see it. First, there's that initial stop. Officer Campbell arrests Mr. Wallace. Officer Campbell finds those guns, and Mr. Wallace is brought back to the jail. That's kind of where the second timeline begins here. We know from video evidence that the time in the jail is at least greater than 1 hour later, and it's at a separate, distinct place as opposed to where the stop took place. The judge says that the defendant's arguments about counts one and two, again, the judge calls it compelling here until he considers these much later acts that occurred at the jail. However, proof for conviction here on these counts needs to be that Mr. Wallace knew that he was consciously aware of the presence of the firearms at the time of the stop. Conduct afterward is irrelevant to showing what Mr. Wallace knew at the time of the stop.
Counsel, I want to, before your time runs out, ask you about the obstructing justice count. Is it your claim that this evidence wasn't sufficient to prove the defendant guilty of obstructing justice?
Yes, Your Honor. The state, with respect to that charge, to the obstruction of justice charge, also did not meet its burden, Your Honor.
Because its burden was the state needed to identify what it was the defendant grabbed and flushed away?
No, Your Honor, the state didn't necessarily need to show precisely what the evidence is, but the state did need to show that it was in fact evidence. As it stands here, the state had testimony saying that it was an item. The state didn't present testimony saying that the item was any sort of anything illegal.
What do you mean when they say it was evidence? It was something, wasn't it?
It was an item, Your Honor. Yes, okay, that's correct.
It was something, and it was something that your client apparently thought sufficiently dangerous to be caught in his possession that contrary to the instructions he received from the police, he grabbed it, threw it in the toilet, and flushed it. As a matter of policy, do you think it would be good policy to permit suspects to destroy evidence that the police otherwise have a right have seen, otherwise have a right to seize?
Your Honor, first I want to mention that you spoke about Mr. Wallace thinking the item was sufficiently dangerous that those actions happened. I dispute that he found that the state even showed at all that Mr. Wallace found that the items were dangerous or anything of that nature. Second, I think that the best
policy what inference here, do you draw as to why the defendant grabbed it and threw it in the toilet and flushed it away?
There's, Your Honor, there's
environmental concerns. Is that what this is about?
Your Honor, there's a number of reasons that it could have happened. It's just as likely I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Give me two. You mentioned there were a number of reasons that could account for this as innocent behavior. I'll settle for two.
Sure thing, Your Honor. He could have been upset with the incidents of the day, didn't feel like complying with orders. It could have been something embarrassing instead of something illegal. There could have been, Your Honor, you said environmental concern. I don't know how that would necessarily relate here. But in terms of the policy, I think the best policy is the state actually has, I see my time's out. May I finish my answer?
Yes.
Thank you, Your Honors. The best policy is to make the state actually prove it, not just show that it was an item, show that it was evidence, show that it had some level of evidentiary value. And I will pick this back up on rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Manchin?
All right. May it please the court, counsel? I will start my argument by addressing the last questions raised regarding the obstructing justice. I think, Justice Steigman, you're perfectly correct that as a policy, the state you cannot say that if you completely destroy the evidence, you're not guilty of obstructing justice. The obstructing justice requires, if the defendant just throws something on the street and police pick it up immediately, he's not guilty of obstructing because he has not materially impaired the prosecution. Well, here, where he has completely destroyed the evidence, the item, he has materially impaired. There is material impairment. And how you can say an item the defendant destroys is not evidence is splitting hairs and ignoring the common sense definition of what is evidence. I think the only reasonable explanation of why the defendant threw this away was because he knew it would it was dangerous for him to be caught with it. The trial judge could draw the reasonable inference that a hockey puck size object wrapped in plastic hidden in somebody's buttocks is more than likely drugs of some kind, because that is a not uncommon means of trying to conceal the evidence. So I think that the obstructing justice was established by the fact that the defendant disobeyed instructions, threw the item in the toilet and destroyed it completely. The inability to specifically identify what it is does not mean that it is not evidence. And with respect to the defendant's actions in flushing the drugs, I think the trial court properly considered that in terms of determining whether the defendant's knowledge of the guns in the car. It is not uncommon, and it is common. In fact, it's one of the factors that is looked to in drug cases as for showing intent to deliver, whether or not the defendant is armed or has a gun at the same time he possesses the drugs. So I think that the possession of the drugs can and was properly used to draw an inference that, hey, the defendant did in fact possess these guns for the purposes of protecting these drugs that the defendant was carrying.
So Ms. Manchin, dealing with prior convictions, the rule is certainly in a jury trial is that before the trier of fact can be informed of a prior conviction for purposes of considering what weight to give it in determining the credibility of a defendant, the trial court must conduct a hearing and weigh the various factors and decide whether it should be admissible for that purpose. Do you agree that the same weighing process applies in a bench trial as well as a jury trial?
I agree that the trial court here erred in his finding that as a convicted felon, the defendant has less credibility. But there was
just addressing my question, though, because I want to make it clear that the same process should apply in a bench trial as well, should it not?
It should, yes.
So but the trial court here erred, but your argument is it wasn't...
It was not plain error because there was no objection below and that the...
plain error could still apply without an objection. If there were objection, we'd be hearing it on the objection basis, wouldn't we?
Yeah, but it is not clear and obvious error requiring reversal because the trial court did not rely upon the trial court's reliance upon the defendant's prior conviction was not so.
Well, let me ask it this way.
I would say
of a first prong plain error, I think it's a clear and obvious error because not only was there no hearing, but if a hearing had been held, it wouldn't have been admissible for that purpose. It's too old. So then the question is, was the evidence closely balanced? Isn't that the first prong inquiry?
Yes, it is. But I think in this case, the trial court's findings show that any reliance upon this improper factor was so minimal that it does not require reversal because he rejected the defendant's argument, not because of the...
But as defense counsels pointed out, the trial court had made some reference to the other evidence the defendant presented about his lack of knowledge of the guns.
Yeah, he referenced it as plausible. But he...
You are involved in this an awful lot. And plausible is a lot better than the usual we hear on
that's correct.
Evidence closely balanced. And, you know,
but the trial court mainly rejected it based upon his finding that the wife's testimony that it was her guns and the defendant didn't know it was just simply not credible. With respect to...
We're pausing there again. For our purposes, because we're called on to evaluate all of this, given the extent of evidence presented here, why shouldn't we deem this closely balanced and reverse the weapons conviction for that reason?
Well, the question on appeal is not the propriety of the trial court's reasoning, but the propriety of the trial court's results. So the invitation to parse the trial court's language should be rejected and just affirmed on the basis that the evidence was sufficient to establish that the defendant's was in possession of the guns.
Well, and the whole question of evaluating whether the evidence is closely balanced, we have on the one hand the question of how the trier of fact viewed it. And of course, here, as opposed to a jury trial, we have the trial court, this trier of fact, explaining its decision. But had this been a jury trial, we just have a guilty verdict. We wouldn't have any explanation by the trier of fact as to why or how much weight it gave to people or how much, let's assume the hypothetical that the trial court conducted a Montgomery hearing and let in this improper impeachment evidence. Wouldn't, without the trial court's discussion of how it evaluated the evidence, which is unusual because most triers of fact don't have that, maybe the jury, wouldn't looking at this record, given the evidence presented by the defense to try to rebut the claim that he knew about the guns in the car, wouldn't that cause us to review this as not clear and convincing evidence, or excuse me, not closely balanced evidence?
I do not believe that the trial court's error was sufficient to require reversal on that basis because of the minimal amount of attention he paid to this. This was a one word reference to the one sentence reference in a I believe it was a five-page finding of fact, discussion of the evidence. to say that the conviction was based upon that erroneous reference, I think, is improper.
Well, you're right that the trial court explained itself, but I'm trying to look at it from the point of view, if this had been a jury trial, we don't have any explanation other than the improper impeachment. And we have all this evidence presented by the defense. At that point, wouldn't the issue for this court be, was it closely balanced, and wouldn't it have crossed that threshold?
I do not believe so.
Okay, go ahead.
With respect to the search and seizure issue, the defendant on appeal does not contend that the trial court erred in denying his motion to suppress. The defendant phrases the issue as a trial counsel was ineffective in the manner in which he presented the motion to suppress. He's not arguing that the trial court was wrong. He says that the manner in which trial counsel presented the issue was ineffective assistance. And he only argues the correctness or questionings the correctness is a per term.
I was under the impression he was challenging the trial court's decision as well.
Well, only in terms of trying to establish prejudice through based on counsel's ineffective assistance. Ineffective assistance requires two things: deficient representation falling below an objective standard of reasonable representation, and prejudice. We cannot show defective representation because the same claim that you can't stop somebody based on tinted windows and the report from Georgia about lack of insurance is the same issue being raised below. So the claim raised in the trial court by counsel did not fall below objective standard. And I think you're correct as far as the statute saying that if you drive in Illinois on an out-of-state license, you need insurance. The report saying that the defendant does not have insurance registered in Georgia as required by Georgia law certainly supports a reasonable inference sufficient to make the stop that the defendant did not have insurance.
Counsel, Mr. Draws argued a few moments ago that the state didn't make the argument that you just stated to.
I did not raise it. They raised it below, but I did not raise it specifically in my brief. I focused in my brief more on the tinting argument. And I think even under the tinting one, there is no Illinois case law regarding stopping out-of-state vehicles as far as whether it's a proper Terry stop or not.
Well, I understand you correctly. I want to make sure. You're asserting that the defendant at trial and on appeal both did not argue that the trial court erred by denying the motion to suppress?
I'm just saying that on appeal, the defendant is not claiming that the trial court erred. He's claiming that his attorney was ineffective in the manner in which he presented the issue, which is an entirely different question.
Why was that? What is?
So well, I'm because it's
an understanding of his argument.
My understanding of his argument is that trial counsel was ineffective because he didn't cite the same cases that he cites on appeal. That's how I read his argument.
Okay, go ahead.
And as far as stopping out-of-state car for tinted windows, I cite two cases in my brief from New Jersey and Maryland, which have similar statutes to Illinois that says that even an out-of-state car can be stopped for tinted windows to check the registration. So that either for the no insurance reference or the tinted windows, that the stop was proper. Um, If there are no further questions, I will stand on my brief with respect to the issues raised.
I see no further questions. Thank you. Mr. Draws, we'll hear from you on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. First, I want to address the state's arguments related to the trial court errors under Montgomery, that is considering Mr. Wallace's prior conviction against his credibility. The state does agree that it applies to a trial court. That's because the propositions that Montgomery stand for, trying a defendant for the case at hand, not trying a defendant based on past conduct. That's the reason why this exists. The state says it was harmless error. I would argue the court says directly, as a convicted felon, Mr. Wallace's word carries less weight. And I don't think that's parsing the trial court's language either. Directly says Mr. Wallace is less credible for this reason. We know that in these plain error cases, in these closely balanced prong of plain error cases, we can look at the Illinois Supreme Court cases, Naylor and Sebi, that says evidence is closely balanced, where it's a credibility call between the officer and the defendant. And it's closely balanced when the judge is deciding based upon that credibility here. This falls directly under and hits every element of that first prong of the plain error rule. I also want to discuss the state's arguments about stop and seizure here. The state argues that I didn't say it was trial court error. That's not correct here. I did argue also, I would direct you to page 38 of the opening brief where I did say that this is ineffective assistance of counsel, or alternatively, if this court does find that that defense counsel did raise these issues, this court should examine the trial court error here. The state also says that there is no case.
Did you ever argue specifically that the trial court erred by denying the motion to suppress?
Yes, I in argument four in the opening brief, and I did. Obviously, the bulk of it went to ineffective assistance of counsel, but additionally, I did argue that in the opening brief, Your Honor.
Other than page 38 in this alternative reference, would you expand upon it at all?
Sure. The motion to suppress, which was basically a post-trial motion at this point, the way this was conducted below, trial counsel did make the arguments that.
Did you, in your brief to this court, other than the one reference you just made, argue that the trial court erred in denying the motion to suppress?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe so, and further. Citing cases like Strawn, citing cases like Patty for the proposition that the trial court erred in denying this as well, Your Honor. The state says there is no case for stopping out of state vehicles based on window tinting. Related to that subject matter, I would strongly disagree with that. On page 41 of my opening brief, I cite this court's decision in People v. Strawn. It says the statute, that's the window tinting statute, contains an exception for vehicles registered in other jurisdictions. Therefore, people from other states can travel into or through Illinois without any impediment due to the presence of tinted windows being placed in their way.
But isn't Deputy Campbell's testimony clear that while he noticed the window tinting, he really stopped this car because of the NCIC message from Georgia regarding insurance?
Your Honor, I don't think Officer Campbell's testimony is clear as to which reason he favored necessarily. What's clear is he only points to those two reasons for the basis of his reasonable suspicion, which is invalid here, being the window tinting. Well,
assuming you're right that the window tinting is invalid, but the NC2I notice is, wouldn't that be sufficient for reasonable, articulable suspicion to stop the vehicle?
Your Honor, I believe that the basis of reasonable suspicion would suffice there. But again, on those prior arguments, this is again runs afoul of the Commerce Clause, the subjecting out-of-state drivers to the Illinois Vehicular Code. And finally, I want to point out There's no authority for the state's contention in its brief that it's reasonable for police to pull over any out-of-state car on the, you know, almost on a fishing expedition to see if there's actually an Illinois resident in it. I know of no authority that actually stands for that purpose. So if there are no further questions, Your Honors, this court should reverse Mr. Wallace's convictions or alternatively remand for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take your matter under advisement. No.